Hi, Nancy Rosenblum. Welcome to Cable here in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Bill. I'm happy to be here.
Nancy Rosenblum is a teacher. She was named a distinguished professor at Harvard's School of Government. She first taught and wrote political theory, but in mid-career, she pivoted to writing about the real world of American politics. Just last year, she published a book, A Lot of People Are Saying. You may recognize that, one of Donald Trump's most absurd contentions. A lot of people are saying, the new conspiracism and the assault on democracy. And in 2016, she authored the book, Good Neighbors, The Democracy of Everyday Life. That's our subject today, democracy in everyday life. So, Nancy Rosenblum, why did you, a teacher of political theory for many years, come to study and write about the most down-to-earth issue of neighborliness and democracy in daily life?
Bill, sometimes something happens and you're just startled into thought. And that's what happened to me. I lived in an apartment building where one of the neighbors put an air conditioner on the roof that vibrated and caused noise. And so his next door neighbor and the whole family was unable to sleep. And they were desperate. He refused to do anything about it. And so the other neighbors in the building sort of rallied around the tormented family, and we spoke out against the offender, and he was intransigent. And we finally decided that we would pool our resources and we would pay to have this air conditioner moved so that our neighbors could sleep at night. That is, we wanted to resist this petty despotism. And that's what sparked my interest, because I realized we were doing something that was democratic, but that was altogether unlike the formal democracy of citizenship or even the sort of organized democracy that goes on in our civil associations, in our advocacy groups, and so on. Then I realized something else about why it is that this was such a powerful experience for me, and that's that neighbors, you can't avoid them. They're there. Proximity matters. And the proximity is a cause for arguments and slights and acts of aggression, and also, of course, for acts of generosity. So people tell their stories about neighbors, and I'm telling this one with enormous feeling. And that's because neighbors are not just proximate to us and unavoidable. It's also that our relations to neighbors take place around home. And we have a special depth and intensity of our interests at home. We expect privacy, we expect control, and yet retreat really is impossible. So here was a sort of sphere of life that really hadn't been written about much before that I thought was morally important, and that also had certain characteristics of democracy, at least neighborliness in the United States does. And I was interested in what that was, what those sort of political morality of neighbors was, and how it could go wrong.
Now, in recognizing that democratic sphere that got so little attention previous to, I think your book actually was eye-opening for lots of people, it received so little attention, and yet, of course, neighborliness is something that we learn and practice, at least many of us learn and practice, and it's not without neighborliness can actually fail and destructive tendencies take over. We'll be talking about that later. But neighborliness is a dominant practice for most people, except in really troubled neighborhoods. It seems to me that another reason, though, for talking about those practices of daily life, including neighborliness, and we'll get to another, some parenting and other things later in the interview, neighborliness is like, in some ways, a school, and it develops ideas and understandings that seems to me that become the predicate or the basis of actually a successful political democracy, which the U.S. may or may not become, one wonders nowadays. Is that part of your
yes, it certainly
of your,
is.
Of your reasoning? Tell us about the relationship between neighborliness and then the political, narrowly defined sphere.
I have an account of the elements of neighborliness, but before I get to it, let me just say that there are two common ways of thinking about neighbors in America. One is just the Old and New Testament injunction to love thy neighbor as thyself. And whatever you think of it, it's a very puzzling thing to imagine that you can love your neighbor as yourself. And the great progressive community organizer, Mary Parker Fox, Collett, you probably know about her, says, "I'm ready to say to you at this minute I love my neighbors, but all that I mean by it is that I have a vague feeling of kindliness to them." And then she admits, "I have no idea how to do the actual deed, how to love my neighbor. I shall offend against the law of love within the hour." So that's one way we think about neighbors, if we think about them at all, in this extremely inaccessible notion of loving them. And the other way is to see neighbors as a kind of school of democracy, that neighborly relations should be sort of organizing together to do something to fix a local problem. And that, too, is a progressive idea. I think Dewey said exactly that, John Dewey, that these were little schools of democracy. And I didn't find either of those really to describe my own experience of neighbors or all the reading that I had done about settlers in America and immigrant communities in America and contemporary neighbors. So I began to think about what are the values, or what are the practices, really, that are signatures of neighbors as opposed to signatures of our lives in politics or our lives in organized associations. And I came up with two principal ones, and you'll see why I call them democratic, even though they don't correspond to political democracy. And one is that what we expect of neighbors is a certain kind of reciprocity. If you're live in a community of need, often the demands on reciprocity can be quite severe. You know, you need a ride to work, or you'll lose your job, or you need some money to get through the month. Sort of like settlers in the old days, where reciprocity amongst neighbors really was a physical necessity. But for many of us, reciprocity is just saying, "How are you today?" and acknowledging greetings and so on and so forth. And what makes reciprocity democratic, besides the fact that it's a kind of give and take in the very local community, is that we tend, then there's a famous phrase for this, we tend to ask, what neighbors deserve our reciprocity? You know, why do we do it? And the answer is, we'll have reciprocity amongst a neighbor as long as they're sort of decent folk, as long as they don't ruin our lives or act intemperately or aggressively, as long as they're not actively hostile. And so we tend to ignore other kinds of things, an economic situation or religion or even ideally or aspirationally race. And so these things, the reciprocity and the fact that it's inclusive, at least if people aren't arrantly, wantonly aggressive towards you, is a kind of democratic interaction, a democratic value. It designates a certain kind of equality, but just equality in this one respect as a neighbor. It separates out the qualities of a neighbor from citizenship or social standing or national origin or whatever. So those are the elements, I think, of good neighborliness here, and it helps you to see when it is that neighborliness fails, when you really do encounter the other person solely in terms of their religion or their race, and not in terms of the special role that we have of being a neighbor.
Bill Resnick here for Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Nancy Rosenblum, who taught at Harvard School of Government, recently wrote the book Good Neighbors: A Democracy of Everyday Life. We've just discussed how neighborliness, we develop tolerance and listening skills and restraint that's necessary in a stable political democracy. Nancy Rosenblum, in your book and writings, you don't romanticize neighborliness or living in neighborhoods. Neighbors can, as in U.S. history, they can lynch their neighbors or send them to internment camps, or economically exploit them using the force of law, or as in Nazi Germany or Stalin's Russia, and many other less terrible situations, neighbors can betray their neighbors. So what do you see as the conditions for what we see as neighborliness? What are the conditions for that type of neighborliness versus neighbors betraying one another and taking advantage of them?
That's a good question. So as you point out, Bill, I have a chapter on lynching, which was often done by people who knew one another or even lived beside one another. I have a chapter on the Japanese internment, where Japanese Americans, but also non-citizens, had lived side by side with white people for many, many years, sometimes for generations, and who, when they were interned, these neighbors not only turned their heads away and didn't protest, but they looted their houses, they took their property, they took over their farms, and the Japanese Americans were never recompensed, and those neighbors who did these things to them were never charged with anything. So they are extraordinary, and we know that, for example, in Stalinist Russia, the secret police used neighbors to inform one another, and even within families, people informed on one another. These are the dramatic degradations of neighborliness, and I think that they all have something in common, and it brings us to my worry about neighbors today. And what they have in common is that they have politicized and used neighbors against one another, so that the Japanese internment story is a story of the national government of the United States declaring that the Japanese on the West Coast, not the Germans, by the way, the Japanese on the West Coast were aliens or traitors or liable to be so, and they were dehumanized by writers, political commentators, by the military, by the Supreme Court. So there was a kind of radical, dramatic, and very quick transformation of these Japanese neighbors from people who were different, with you might or might not like them, you might have had struggles with them on the ordinary day-to-day basis, but who had become dehumanized and alien to you, and then you would feel free to, or many people would feel free to, exploit them and damage them. And the same thing is obviously true of lynching. That is, you had a regime after Reconstruction, all the way into the 1930s and 40s in the South, a legal regime of white supremacy and immunity, legal immunity to the most monstrous kinds of behavior towards blacks. These were situations that were created by and enforced by governments. Now, that's not to say that you would have had benign racial relations without it. Of course, you would not have, but you would not have had the kind of horror that you had with lynching or with Japanese internment and other examples. And let me go back and say that what I've discovered is that even in these most dramatic situations, there were neighbors who kept up the norms of reciprocity and of seeing these neighbors as decent folk. And there are wonderful stories that I also tell about neighbors who visited their Japanese former neighbors in internment camps, who took care of their property, who even worked their farms so that when they came back, they would come back to something. And the same thing is true amongst whites and blacks in the period, long period of racial violence and lynching in the South. So there is always a residue. It is never completely eliminated. But what this brings me to is my concern today, because what we've seen under Trump, but it went on for probably 20 years before that, of a gradual releasing of white supremacy and violence, and abetted by conspiracism and by the disruption of government, that has seeped down from the level of politics and the level of sort of organized groups for and against white supremacy and for and against Trump and so on into neighborhoods. So that you began to see, when Trump was elected, all kinds of stories and even some data on the way in which neighbors who had lived together reasonably amicably, according to the norms that I set out, who began to fear one another, who began to see one another as an enemy, who stopped talking to one another, who began to harass one another. And that has come to a head, I think, Bill, with COVID, where we see neighbors who are fearful of one another, who are disdainful of one another, who are willing to give one another a deadly disease, and so on. And so, once again, it is the neighborly sphere, which has never been sacrosanct or completely cordoned off from society or government, but which had its own norms and relations that revolved around living next to one another indefinitely. And we see how vulnerable they are, how quickly they can be completely eclipsed by a radical and extremist and a very destructive politics.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick for Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, talking to Nancy Rosenblum. Pardon, Harvard School of Government recently wrote the book Good Neighbors, A Democracy of Everyday Life. We've just discussed how neighborhoods do not necessarily produce democracy. People can kill their neighbors or enslave them. And we discussed the social and economic conditions that lead to undemocratic and sometimes murderous action, and pointed out that action from the top, from leadership, had a lot to do with undermining neighborliness and leading to sometimes murderous outcomes. Nancy, right now this country is in great trouble, unable to respond to various crises, accelerating climate change, growing inequality, precariousness, corporate domination of government that's now paralyzed, unable to act. And as you pointed out, now COVID that's been disastrously handled and undermined people's confidence in government and public action. And finally, we have a deranged person with a vast following, many hostile to people of color and science and indeed democracy, unless it delivers, of course, what they want. Anyway, they and their great leader could take over this country, which is a fearsome thought. My sense is that this dismal story, though, is not the whole picture. So I'll leave you with the last word. What do you see as the way out of this dilemma? And how can we build this, capitalize on all of the democratic impulses in everyday life, including neighborliness that still exists, to build movements which would change the way the economy operates and basically many areas of daily life in the United States, how we produce things and how we consume, and how can we build that democratic movement?
Bill, that's the question, isn't it? I think that we are building a democratic movement. I think that we often see organized resistance when times are the darkest. And I think that we're seeing that here. If you look at the last 5 years, there has been an enormous amount of mobilization against the worst. I think that Black Lives Matter at its height was one of the largest social movements in American history by numbers. The Women's March after Trump was inaugurated was, I believe, the largest march in the United States. So I think that we are seeing organized political advocacy group and organization and large-scale social movements. And what's most important is that these movements be translated into electoral power, into votes. And we see an effort at that like none I've ever seen in my lifetime, and that may not have existed before. So all of that makes me hopeful. Since we're talking about neighbors, the question is, what the most local level and the people who live in your building have to do with this. And I think that it's important that some of the most important or critical political issues are local issues. Police violence is one. Climate change is actually a very local issue if you think about the adaptation that has to happen to make people able to live in a healthy way in this environment. And that's going to be very different, you know, in Palo Alto or in where you are than it is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or if you're in Florida. So I think that the very issues that are most critical today have become local issues, including COVID. The areas in which people will not get vaccinated and are spreading this disease to one another are local areas. So localism has become very important. And while neighbors per se don't organize, one neighbor who joins an advocacy group and has a march against police violence in the area recruits other neighbors. That's how you get people into these organizations and mobilize them. You invite them and you invite people you live with, live near and by. So I think that there is both a democratic mobilization and that it extends to the local level. And that makes me hopeful. And the last thing I'll just say about this is that I think that Biden's plans, and it depends, of course, on him being successful, getting them legislatively passed and implemented, to the extent that they show people that the national government matters, that it can deliver things to them that really they desperately need and that they can get efficiently and in a reasonably fair way, having positive expectations from government will help democratic mobilization as well.
Nancy Rosenblum, thanks so much for talking to us today. Yes, there are hopeful signs, and there are very troubling signs. Only, I guess, in our daily actions will history be made. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Bill.